Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 1st, 2015. Nigerians have a new president and some citizens are already skeptical about the abilities of President-elect Muhammadu Buhari to address the country's insecurity.
He will turn the country around, we know that, but it's going to take time because the country is in a state of complete decay. So we are not under any illusion that there is a miracle going to happen straight away.
And analysts say the cost of war in South Sudan is very high for South Sudanese as well as citizens of other countries.
If conflict continues for another 1 to 5 years, it will cost South Sudan between 22.3 and 28 billion US dollars.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But we first go to Nigeria. Nigerian President-elect Muhammadu Buhari says his country has embraced democracy and put its one-party state behind. Mr. Buhari spoke in Abuja just hours after the Electoral Commission declared him the official winner of Saturday's presidential election. He defeated incumbent Goodluck Jonathan by more than 2 million votes. President Jonathan's People's Democratic Party has ruled Nigeria since 1999. Mr. Buhari of All Progressive Congress is to be inaugurated on May 29. As Anne Luke reports from Abuja, people say democracy is the real winner here as the country embarks on its first democratic, peaceful transfer of power since the end of military rule in 1999.
Celebrations erupted before final results were even announced. It was game over for the People's Democratic Party, which has monopolized Nigerian politics for 16 years. President Goodluck Jonathan conceded and called for peace.
The unity, stability, and progress of our dear country is more important than anything else.
Mr. Buhari saluted his opponent's statesmanship and congratulated Nigerians. One-party rule is over, he said.
We have proven to the world that we are people who have embraced democracy and are people who seek a government.
The fourth time was the charm for this ex-military ruler and longtime presidential candidate. The vote is being praised as Nigeria's freest and most transparent yet, despite logistical delays and technical issues at the polls. The opposition united in 2013, forming the All Progressives Congress. The party pledged change amid unfettered corruption, near constant power cuts, and a sinking, oil-dependent economy. APC supporters started gathering at party headquarters Tuesday in Abuja, waiting for Mr. Buhari as results were being announced.
He will turn the country around, we know that, but it's going to take time because the country is in a state of complete decay. So we are not under any illusion that there is a miracle going to happen straight away.
As Mr. Buhari takes office, the Boko Haram insurgency rages on in the northeast. It intensified dramatically on Mr. Jonathan's watch. Thousands of civilians have been killed, more than 1 million displaced. Borno State has been the most affected. That state's results were the last to come in. A new era is about to be Borno, tweeted one Nigerian. The APC dominated the north in this vote and scored key victories in the southwest, a stark change from the last PDP win in 2011. Kano, the largest city in the north, partied into the night. People cheered as drivers spun their cars around a roundabout. There was giddiness and a sense of empowerment in the streets. People danced. They jumped up and down. In Abuja, they chanted and sang Father, Father in Hausa. But they also said they want results, and they will let Mr. Buhari know how he's doing in 4 years at the next election. And look, VOA News, Abuja.
A new report on the ongoing conflict in South Sudan concludes that if the fighting continues for another 5 years, it would cost South Sudan up to $28 billion. The report, produced jointly by Juba University's Center for Peace and Development Studies, Frontier Economics, and the Uganda-based Center for Conflict Resolution, also says it would cost the United States and other countries billions of dollars in peacekeeping operations if the fighting continues. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Luka Byong Deng, director of Juba University's Center for Peace and Development Studies, who presented the findings in a public lecture Monday night in Juba, says the report looks at the cost of war on South Sudan, the region, and the international community. He says because of the massive displacement of populations, insecurity and instability caused by the fighting, the country's gross domestic product, that's the monetary value of goods and services produced in South Sudan, will decline by 15% over a few years if the fighting continues.
And based on that projection, if conflict continues for another 1 to 5 years, it will cost South Sudan between $22.3 and $28 billion. But if the war continues with an effect for almost 20 years, then the loss may be between $122 billion to $158 billion.
On military spending alone, Byong says it's going to cost South Sudan $2.2 billion if the conflict continues for 5 years.
And subsequently, you could see the diversion of resources to the military expenditure. And in actual fact, people say this will... This expenditure that we are having now, $2.2 billion, if we were to use it for the education and health, we could have achieved the international target of 20% of spending for education.
Millions of South Sudanese have been displaced and millions of others are food insecure due to the conflict. Byong says the decline in productivity will cost South Sudan some $6 billion. And the fighting has affected other countries. According to the African Development Bank, the GDP of South Sudan's neighbors declined by 1% in 2014, which was caused by the conflict. Byong says while some neighboring countries could have benefited from the fighting in small ways, if it continues for another 5 years or so, Ethiopia, Sudan, Kenya, and Uganda would lose up to $53 billion. And Byong says the cost to the international community will be very high if the fighting continues.
And it has been put around $30 billion could have been saved by the international community in peacekeeping and humanitarian assistance.
Edmond Yakani, executive director of Community Empowerment for Progress organization, says aside from the financial cost, the war has led to an increase in criminal behavior as residents try to deal with the economic difficulties they face.
Criminal armed groups start merging up. And because of the economical pressure, the limitation of economical opportunity, the shrinking of economical opportunity, and they start targeting where they can see they can earn their living through using the barrel of the gun.
And Byong says, whenever war breaks out in a country, it's important to remember that the effects of the war will continue for as long as 30 years. The joint report recommends the leaders of the warring parties move quickly to end the conflict now and minimize the costs of war to South Sudan and the rest of the world. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Still on fighting, reports from Upper Nile State says government forces clashed with rebels today. The SPLM in opposition alleges that government troops launched an attack at Mangok and Longichok County east of Malakal. But South Sudan army officials say they have not heard of any fighting in the area from their commanders. VOA fellow Michael Atit has more on this story from Washington.
Peter Hothquach, the Minister of Information in Upper Nile State, says he received no reports of fighting in Mangok so far today.
But I know the tension has been high in Longichok County. The rebel movement has been monitored by the government for the last 4 days. So if there is any attacks, we will not be surprised to hear such information.
Dixon Gatluak is the deputy spokesperson for the SPLA in opposition, confirms there is fighting, but says the SPLA in opposition is not involved in these latest clashes.
Yeah, of course, as we speak, there is a fighting that is going on in Malakal town in a certain area called Akoka. And the two warring parties are not our forces. These are not the SPLA in opposition. These are the Shuluk militia fighting with the government.
Gatulak says he is not surprised to hear the Shuluk militia in Malakal are turning against the government, saying it is a long time coming.
Juba regime has been recruiting the children, and at the same time they have been committing atrocities against the local population within the Malakal town. And this has been taking place for so long, and the Shuluk community has been ignoring this since the crisis started. But at the moment, as we speak, they have decided to rebel against the government and they took arms.
Gatluak denies there is any link between the SPLA in opposition and the Shuluk militia in Malakal at the moment. Meanwhile, Kwach says there are no reports of fresh fighting either in the northern or western Malakal. Meanwhile, Kwach says there are no reports of fresh fighting either in north or west of Malakal, the capital of Upper Nile State. But he says the eastern territory of the state bordering Ethiopia remains tense. He says Nasser town, which government forces controls, have experienced daily shelling from the opposition forces.
The situation in Nasser is constant. The constant, the rebel constantly bombarded, but very far, they use a artillery bomb bombardment, artillery shell with mortar bombs.
SPLA Army spokesman Colonel Philip Aguirre could not be reached for comment. Defense Minister Kwal Manyang says he has not received any information regarding military activities in Upper Nile State today. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Washington.
Authorities in Jonglei and Central Equatoria States say they are trying to find out who brutally killed a group of business people last month as they travel on the River Nile. Officials say the business people traveled to Terekeka from Bor last month to buy livestock. It is thought they were killed and their bodies dumped into the river last week as they were making their way back to Bor. This report by Jacob Ochiek contains details some of our listeners may find disturbing.
Officials and relatives of the business people say they left Terekeke by boat on March 28. They were not heard from after that, and the boat they were on, which was also carrying a cargo of goats and cows that they had bought, has not been found. Bor County Commissioner Mame Rook says a first body was fished from the Nile in Bor yesterday. The victim's hands were tied. He says he had been shot several times. Rook identified the victim as Bor County resident Joel McQuay. Rook says officials believe the boat victim were troubled on.
Fall into ambush between Jameza and Terekeke. The boat was attacked, all the passengers were killed, animals were taken away, both goat and cows.
Residents of Bor County says they saw eight bodies floating in the river. Rook says one of the victims was a woman called Keji from Central Equatoria. Terekeke County Commissioner Jacob Gore Samuel says he believes that boat was attacked shortly after leaving Terekeke near the village of Jameza. He said the chief and sub-chief of the boomers in Jameza have been arrested and are being questioned by the authorities to try to get to the bottom of what happened to the business people. Samuel says that as soon as he got a report that there was an incident on the river, he dispatched security personnel to scan to investigate. He said they reported back to him that herders in a cattle camp had carried out the attacks. Samuel says police and army forces will be sent to the area where the alleged ambush happened. He said they will apprehend the suspect attackers and bring them to justice. Rook hailed the quick reaction of Terekeke official to the attack. He called on local community to work together to avoid tension, peering over the afferent murders of the traders. Bor Mayor Nial Majak is calling on local community to unite in the face of the tragedy.
As authorities of Jonglei State and as the mayor of Bor, I'm asking our brothers and sisters from Terekeke to observe peace so that peaceful coexistence of the people of South Sudan is observed. I'm saying this because it is important that our road and the rivers are made safe for the safe passage for the people. And the citizens of South Sudan all deserve to use the River Nile Basin and the road safely. So it is our responsibility as leaders to make sure that our citizens in our territories are safe.
Aid agencies and South Sudan have complained of rising insecurity on river and road in South Sudan, especially since the country plunged into a conflict in December 27. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a closer look at food insecurity in the Horn of Africa. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how often do you use your mobile phone to access the internet?
I use it very often. It allows me to Google in any information I have. Sometimes I use a Bing search to also find out any information at all that I have, and I'm able to access that.
I use it daily, yeah, especially in the morning hours, especially if I don't have anything to do. I go and see what is new. As we know, we have a problem in our country, and we have to go every minute and every second to see what are the process going on. Is peace coming soon?
It's like having tea in the morning. Now mobile telephones are everything, my special smartphone. So internet is part and parcel of my life.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. In our continuing series this week on food insecurity, aid agencies began warning last week that without intervention, populations in South Sudan were at risk of falling into famine as a result of ongoing civil conflict. But government has denied the report and says humanitarian groups are using the warning as a ploy to raise money. VOA's Gabe Joslo looks into the politics of famine and why food security is such a sensitive issue.
The United Nations says more than 260,000 people were killed as a result of the famine that struck areas of Somalia in July 2011. The regional director for the United Nations World Food Program, Valerie Guarnieri, tells VOA that while the warnings were issued months in advance, the response was not enough to avoid catastrophe.
In Somalia, the sense was that while there was some alarm bell ringing that was happening earlier in the year from WFP among them, that the alarm wasn't sounded loud enough and sort of clearly enough to facilitate that kind of response. So the response only came after the famine was declared. And that's really just, it's unconscionable. It's just too late.
A report from Oxfam and Save the Children, released in 2012 after the Somalia crisis had subsided, said one reason for the slow response was that raising money for humanitarian efforts too often depends on media and public attention to a crisis. The evidence for that is in the data. Figures provided by the United Nations show that donors contributed $342 million to the Somalia appeal in July and August of 2011 after the famine was declared, which is more than the total funding received during the first half of the year. Guarnieri says in the past, it could take up to 3 months to convert funding into food, but that with new planning techniques, the UN has sped that process up to 2 weeks. Still, she says one of the problems is that donors want to see their money in action, like food dropped from an airplane. But by that point, the crisis is already in full swing. It is sometimes hard to convince them to support contingency plans instead.
There's an understanding that a pledge made as a forecast allows us to move faster, but there's also always a desire when you make a contribution to then, after your contribution, see that tangible assistance being delivered on the ground. So we're trying to address what are some sort of donor visibility issues.
Early warning systems take into account some of the expected indicators of crisis: malnutrition, harvests, food availability. But the UN is also working on better predicting political problems to give agencies a jump on potential emergencies. Guarnieri says political mapping is more art than science at this point, but that agencies are using the system to plan for Burundi, where political tensions have been on the rise ahead of elections in June.
We've been working as the UN and supporting the country team to develop a contingency plan for Burundi in the event that the upcoming elections result in displacement or conflict beyond just a sporadic incident. We're working with government as well on that plan, and there's going to be a simulation in the coming weeks where we start to test some of the assumptions of the plan to really see how ready we are.
Despite lessons learned from past emergencies, contingency planning and funding still remains a huge challenge. The most recent data shows that in South Sudan, for instance, where agencies have been warning of the possibility of famine for months, a UN humanitarian appeal for $1.8 billion has received less than 8% of the requested funding. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
A former United Nations humanitarian officer for Somalia says South Sudan can learn lessons from how the Somalis survived after the famine hit the country more than 25 years ago. Peter Tingwa says the government in Juba and international aid agencies should help farmers in areas that are not affected by the conflict to grow more food. He says South Sudanese farmers have the potential to feed the nation and avert famine. Tingwa says Somali farmers, with the help of international aid agencies, were able to provide enough food to feed their people after the famine.
Somalia broke into clans, and one clan was fighting the other. So people were not able to cultivate. Then the famine came in. And the thing with the famine is every year the production reduces. For example, if this year there was a war, next year there will be less indigenous production, and the year after another less. So that is how it went until serious starvation came.
Apart from the war and the natural calamities that contributed to Somalia's famine, what was happening in areas that were considered in Somalia as an agricultural belt?
Kismayu is at the mouth of the river. So the valley is very rich, and bananas were produced there. And so many other valleys, the Jubo Valley, Chabele Valley, and then the Baidoa area, they are all productive, agricultural productive areas. But when there is war and people are running, then you cannot get the production. And the humanitarian community or the international community did respond, led by WFP. Food was brought to the port in Mogadishu, but it couldn't be taken inside. All the highways were roadblocks by militia who would tax the relief agencies. So the relief agencies were not able to go, and people were dying at hinterlands. This is the first time UN intervened into a country based on humanitarian things. UN has always intervened because of political things, military or fighting. But in Somalia at that time, the UN intervened in order to force, open the ways so that food would go to the hinterlands where people were dying. So that was the situation. It was very bad.
After the famine, what did the Somalis do to help the situation of food security in that area?
Of course, at that time there was no Somalia government. So under Chapter 7, food was taken, whether the militia liked it or not. And the food distribution was combined with the giving of agricultural inputs like seeds and tools and fertilizers or so. So really, by 1993, Somalia had somewhat corrected the serious food shortage.
Are there lessons that South Sudan could learn from what happened in Somalia?
I think there are many ways we could overcome that. One, now that the international community is aware, the protagonists could agree so that corridors are open to people in need, so that food is taken there. Two, the war is not engulfing the whole of South Sudan. There are areas like, you take Western Equatoria or Yei or so. Those areas should be made to produce more so that food does not have to come from outside. The international community and our government could encourage production of food in the areas that are stable.
That's Peter Tingwa, a South Sudanese national who worked in Somalia as senior humanitarian officer during Somalia's famine 25 years ago. He was speaking to me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, earlier today. Tomorrow in our series on food insecurity, we talk about under- and overnutrition. A young South Sudanese woman in Canada is about to publish her first book of poetry. The poems in Nyaboy's Gadbel's book, The Fire Within, have a uniquely South Sudanese focus on what it is like to grow up as a refugee in a camp in Ethiopia and in Canada. VOA fellow Lucy Pony talked to her.
You went kept dropping the soccer maze. It's incredible how people seem to be amazed. How is it that food fell from the heavenly sky? I wonder how did we get here? You see men and women running to grab a soccer maze. You see older adults fighting over food they can grow. The farmland left unkept because the UN provides food now. Wow, the farm is totally abandoned because it's too much work.
That is 21-year-old Gadbel reading her poem, The Sack of Maize. That poem and many others are included in The Fire Within, Gadbel's first collection of poetry, which will be published in May and released in June in English and Gadbel's native Nuer language. Gadbel says she's been writing poems since she was a child growing up in Ethiopia and in Canada. She says writing helped her to express her feelings and try to figure out who she was.
And I felt like as a person I had so many ideas or ideologies that I've developed throughout the years of being in both places. And I felt like I wasn't really represented neither by each culture because I felt like I wasn't Canadian and I wasn't technically African enough. So I kind of felt like in terms of how I thought about things, my view, it fell somewhere in the middle. And so what I did is as a kid to kind of express myself, I would write poetry.
Gadbel writes mainly of her experiences but also touches on societal issues of race, feminism, poverty, war and education. She says seeing South Sudanese men mistreat women in Ethiopia and even in Canada, knowing that South Sudanese women have been and still are deprived of education, and the impact of an almost continuous war on the people of South Sudan were some of the spurs that drove her to write her brutally honest poems. Gadbel says she is wary of what kind of reception her poetry will be given, especially in South Sudan.
I'm not going to lie, I am a bit scared because a lot of things in there are really they're going to challenge social norms. And so I'm making myself vulnerable because now our society is heavily patriarchal. We're not really ready to be questioned. We're not really ready for women to do what they're best at. We're not really ready yet. There's a lot that's going on, and I feel like we have to talk about the hard stuff if we really want any change in South Sudan.
Gadbel says women should question why they are kept on the sidelines of politics, society and the public space. She says women should not wait for men to give them permission to do what they know they can do. Gadbel says South Sudanese women must stand up for their daughters so that future generations of women are educated and can make informed decisions about their lives. And Gadbel leads by example. She is in her second year at Mount Royal University in Canada, where she is studying for a Bachelor of Arts degree. And then, of course, there are her poems that push the barrier of what's culturally acceptable in South Sudan. Poems like this one.
My God is not a he or a she. My God is not a gender but a spirit. My God is not Islam or Christianity. My God is beyond labels and limitations of man. My God cannot be contained in a book. My God is not trapped in the pages of man. My God is not carved idol hanging on the wall. My God is not the necklace you have on your neck. My God is not responsible for all the wrong in the world. My God is boundaryless and merciful. My God loves all the gays, bisexuals, and heterosexuals. My God is the spirit that lives within all of us. My God is the confidence that lives within us. My God is the natural love and goodness within all of us. My God is my God, and you can't put it in a box, and you can't put it a definition to it.
For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
And that story by Lucy Pony marks the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Fiso Talaga by CJ Oman. Fiso Talaga Uta Baba Fiso Talaga Uta Baba. We have been listening to a little bit of a test of CJ Oman's song, Fiso Talaga. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your cars and homes. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Umadomu tumajalaba, unyorkude azuraba.